Welcome to the Urantia Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Watkins, a 30-year reader of the Urantia book. And it's always a pleasure to be here, and it's always a pleasure to share the Urantia book with you, wherever you might be. I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to take a moment with me and talk about the Urantia Revelation. There's always so much to talk about. We have a lot of good things coming up on the program. We're going to talk about the importance of religion in society. There was a new Gallup poll put out this week that talks about the decline of religious association in our culture. So I thought we would take a little bit of a look at that and maybe take a look at from the Urantia perspective and talk about some of the ways that we might be able to improve that situation. Also, we want to talk about, which is kind of cool, tied into it, is I was doing some thinking about continental drift. Are you familiar with continental drift? Well, continental drift, Pangea, these are all geological terms that state that there's a theory, and it's a well-believed theory at this point because we have sonar and other ways we can confirm it. But the plates of the Earth, at one point, all of the continents were one giant continent, and they drifted apart. And there was a theory floating around the turn of the 20th century where they're trying to figure out why the countries, when you look at them from space or on a map, they look like they could kind of fit into one another, right? And so this guy Alfred Wegener back in 1912 had read some other previous articles that were written by various people in the late 1800s that had sort of surmised that, well, maybe the continents were all one continent at one point. Well, if they separated, what caused that to happen? And that was the thing that was getting scientists. They couldn't quite figure out what was causing the continents to separate. Anyway, so Wegener came up with this theory in 1912 that it was called continental drift. And from 1912 until like 1968, as recent as 1968, science started to recognize through sonar technology and magnetic detection that indeed the plates were once joined and that they were being pushed apart by forces underneath the mantle of the Earth having to do with convection. And lo and behold, the Urantia book in 1934 states emphatically that continental drift is accurate and it is true and it is verified. And they even go into explaining why that is. Now, why is this significant, do you think? Well, because the Urantia book could have been wrong. 1934, it was a theory proposed by Alfred Wegener, but it was not yet an accepted scientific fact. It was still a hypothesis, but it couldn't be explained. So the Urantia book authors, whoever they were, got it right. That's it. They got it right. And what that means is that in 1934, now the book wasn't published until 1955. Okay, the final plates, I think, were set in 42. So we could argue that even if the plates had been set in 42, even if it hadn't been, it was still a theory at the time, continental drift. And the Urantia book being published in 1955, still continental drift was not an accepted fact. So it was still predating scientific discovery. And that in itself proves that the Urantia writers, at least on that particular subject, oh, look, that's so hilarious. My iPhone started pulling up Wikipedia articles on continental drift, which we're going to get to maybe a little later if we have time. But anyway, this all came about because that big volcano in the Caribbean is erupting, and the subject of continental drift came up. And so if you read, I think, I want to say it's section 3, I think the third or fourth section, early land mammal stage. I'll pull it up for you a little bit later. But it is interesting that once again the Urantia book is victorious in declaring a scientific fact years, even decades, before scientists could do so. And that in itself validates once more the authenticity and the credibility of the Urantia Papers. So I do want to get to a couple of other things. First of all, UBIS is starting April 12th, which has already started this past month, Monday. Courses begin a week. Is that today, tomorrow, April 19th? I think they let you jump in the week ahead. So if you're listening and it's before April or just around April 19th, today is April 18th for those who care, you still have time to jump on the UBIS course. And I did mention this in previous podcasts. Just go to Urantia.org and you can sign up. And it's a 10-week course, and it's a lot of fun, and you get to meet other Urantia book readers, and you get to read and share different thoughts on the different subject matter in the Urantia book. So I encourage you to check it out. Also coming up, and if you can register, this is a big one, the Urantia Association International, Truth Book, Urantia Peru, the Urantia Book Fellowship, and the Urantia Foundation are all having a big symposium coming up. If I can get out of this page, it's a big symposium that's coming up in April, and it's going to be live in Peru, and it is going to be for 2 days, a 2-day event, and it's online. So that means you can jump in and jump off when you want to, and you can check it out. It's a virtual experience, and it'll be taking place in Bogota and in Lima and in Quito, and they're going to have workshops, and you can just tune in or you can participate. And if you want more information on that, also go to Urantia.org, Urantia.org. So I wanted to cover those two things. Then there was one more thing that's kind of cool if you want to get involved, and I'll share that with you. The Urantia Book Fellowship is starting to produce videos and web pages for people who have not yet been introduced to the Urantia Book. And they want to focus on the meanings and the values of the Urantia Book, and believe that if they can create media that can inspire people, even in a small way, that that person will be encouraged to continue in their personal spiritual growth. That's a good cause, isn't it? Boy, we could all use some spiritual growth, couldn't we? Now, if they're interested enough and ready, they will contact us, and you can go on and you can just do a little video with your smartphone. It can be 5 minutes. It can be 3 minutes. I personally advise you to get a good microphone, or stand in a room like a closet where the sound is not echoey, and just practice a couple times saying what you think is important about the Urantia book in your life, why you came to believe it, maybe even what you think the afterlife is all about. Anything that you want to say that you think would help someone either get started on their spiritual path, or perhaps even get started on reading some of the part of the book, the Urantia Papers. So there you go. And again, you can get this information by going to the fellowship website. And what is that website? Urantiabook.org. Urantiabook.org. Okay? So there you go. A couple of things we wanted to cover. And now we'll get into the meat and potatoes about this article that talks about the decline of religion in our society. And I want to share with you two things we're going to talk about in this section or segment of the podcast. One is on continental drift, and it's important. Even if you're not into geology, I promise you I'll make it interesting, okay? Because really, this is just about proving the Urantia book is an authentic document. Because I do want to make a couple of points here. We have in our possession a revelatory document, and I want to get to a little bit about cultural decline and what happens to societies when their cultures start to decline. And part of me believes that the Urantia book came into existence for us to prevent or offset or to minimize the cultural decline that we could be enduring for several hundred years. So we'll get to that. And that's why it's important, because people that I talk to or I reference the Urantia book, they'll say, well, how do you know it's true? I would say, look, if something makes assertions at the time that aren't verifiable, but then later turn out to be true, doesn't that give you an indication that if they got that right, they probably got the other stuff right too? I mean, you find that a lot when you're reading. For example, I was reading in the Urantia book, and we talked about this in the last podcast, about Jesus's life during the period of the resurrection. Did we talk about that? Yeah, because we were talking about the period of time between the tomb being empty and when Jesus had his Marantia experiences with his fellows. And much of that is notated in the books of the Gospels of John, Mark, and certainly in Acts, where it covers that period where Jesus spent with his apostles. But if you noticed, every once in a while, the revelators will throw in a little nugget of something else that was going on at the same time. So for an example, in the Urantia book, when it's talking about the post-resurrection period during the Marantia appearances, where he's appearing as an angel before the Greeks and Mary Magdalene and the apostles and Mark and John Mark, all that, right? But then they throw in a little bit of a, well, he also was entertaining all of the student visitors from the entire universe that happened to be in town that week. Didn't say it that way. But it reminds us that this isn't just a human story. This is a bigger picture story, that Jesus didn't just come here for us. He came here for an entire universe. And so that's why these little nuggets of truth are important, because what they do is they substantiate the authenticity and the credibility of the papers themselves. So that's why I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about the continental land drift and why it's important, because it predated what science was later confirmed, and I'm going to show that to you. So in paper 58, the continental land drift continued, they write. The Earth's core had become as dense and as rigid as steel, being subjected to a pressure of almost 25 tons to the square inch. Now, at the time this was written in 34, geologists did not know any of this. And we still may not. And owing to the we might have figured it out by now. And owing to the enormous gravity pressure, it was and still is very hot in the deep interior. The temperature increases from the surface downward until at the center it is slightly above the surface temperature of the sun. The outer 1,000 miles of the Earth's mass consists principally of different kinds of rock. So what they're basically establishing is that the heavier elements sank during the earlier periods. It says the outer crust was about 40 miles thick. This outer shell was supported by and rested directly upon a molten sea of basalt of varying thickness, a mobile layer of molten lava held under high pressure, but always tending to flow hither and yon in equalization of shifting planetary pressures, thereby tending to stabilize the Earth's crust. Even today, the continents continue to float upon this non-crystallized, cushiony sea of molten basalt. Were it not for this protective condition, the more severe earthquakes would literally shake the world to pieces. Earthquakes are caused by sliding and shifting of the solid outer crust, and not by volcanoes. The lava layers of the Earth's crust, when cooled, form granite. The average density of our world is little more than 5.5 times that of water. The density of granite is less than 3 times that of water. The Earth's core is 12 times as dense as water. So the Earth's core is much more dense. All the heavy metals, iron, all of that, compressed, and gravity just pulling all of this material together, and it drives up the heat. So in paper 58, paragraph 5, the sea bottoms are more dense than the land masses, and this is what keeps the continents above water. When the sea bottoms are extruded from above the sea level, they are found to consist largely of basalt, a form of lava considerably heavier than the granite of the land masses. Again, if the continents were not lighter than the ocean beds, gravity would draw the edges of the oceans up onto the land. But such phenomena are not observable. The weight of the oceans is also a factor in the increase of pressure on the seabeds. The lower but comparatively heavier ocean beds, plus the weight of the overlaying water. Think about how heavy it is at the deepest part, at the Marianas Trenches of the Pacific Ocean, just off the coast of like the Philippines and Japan and Australia and all that. It is, heavy, heavy water, just that pressure that's being pushed, right? And so that sort of forces the lighter continents up. But all continents tend to creep into the oceans. This is interesting. If you look at a map, if you look at Google Earth, look at the depth of the ocean right off the part of Japan, and you'll see that's why the Fukushima reactor there, it's right off this. So let me read this. Take this in mind. All continents tend to creep into the oceans. The continental pressure at ocean bottom levels is about 20,000 pounds to the square inch. That is, man, you imagine 20,000 pounds to the square inch. Woo! That's why when they go on those submarines, man, you get crushed to death, right? That would be the pressure of continental mass standing at 15,000 feet above the ocean floor. So they're trying to explain the difference between the weight of the continents versus the concentrated weight of the ocean floors. And so there's one paragraph where it sort of gets a little bit almost prophetic. And I'll read it to you because it's talking about Japan. Watch. Depression of the ocean bottom during the pre-life ages had an upthrust of solitary continental landmass to such a height that its lateral pressure tended to cause the eastern, western, and southern fringes to slide downhill, overlying the semi-viscous lava beds into the waters of the surrounding Pacific Ocean. So this fully compensated the continental pressure that a wide break did not occur on the eastern shore of this ancient Asiatic continent. So what they're saying is that the distribution of weight was such where it didn't break off like it did in other parts of this massive continent. But it also adds, but ever since has that eastern coast line hovered over the precipice of its adjoining oceanic depths, threatening to slide into a watery grave. And they're talking about Japan and the Philippines and that whole area of the eastern, I guess for us it would be the western Pacific, but the east coast of Asia. So they're sort of saying, you know, that's real close. That could slide into, wouldn't that be weird if that happened in our lifetime? Well, you would have almost a prophecy right here. Okay, so now that's all what the Urantia book says about continental drift. Now let's get to what Wikipedia says, and I'll spare you. But basically, as I mentioned previously, Albert Wegener came up with this theory because the continents all look like they fit together. Then in 1947, a team of scientists led by Maurice Ewing confirmed the existence of the rise in Central Atlantic Ocean and found that there were ridges that were detected that sort of differentiated between the continents and the ocean beds. And then come along scientists began to recognize magnetic variations across the ocean floor from 1959 to 1963. They determined that there was this magnetic force moving through the ocean floors in zebra-like patterns. And then finally, they get to the explanation of what they now believe is the evidence that shows that continental drift is true. And it was published in 1968. And it says, the modern theory of plate tectonics, refining Wegener, explains that there are two kinds of crust of different composition. Continental crust and oceanic crust, both floating above a much deeper plastic mantle. Plastic meaning it can adjust, it can bend, it can move. And that what the Urantia book called the mantle, right? Because there was a distribution. The lava flow, the basalt underneath gives it this flexibility. Continental crust is inherently lighter. Going back to the Urantia book where it says the continents, because they are lighter than the pressure and the gravitational pressure and the weight of the oceans, pushes these up. Oceanic crust is creating at spreading centers, and this, along with subduction, drives the system of plates in a chaotic manner, resulting in continuous orogeny and areas of isostatic imbalance, which is scientific for everything the Urantia book just said. Says evidence for the movement of continents on tectonic plates is now extensive. Similar animal and And they say that similar plant and animal fossils are found around the shores of different continents, suggesting that they were once joint. And that also is suggested in the Urantia book, because there are certain animal species in Australia that, you know, that shouldn't be there. How did they get there, right? If they hadn't come from Asia when once joined. So anyway, that's just about what you could say would validate the Urantia book, I would think. Maybe I could be wrong, but that to me tells me that we're getting close. And it should give you, and when I say we're getting close, what I mean is we're getting closer to the truth, which is the Urantia book is a revelatory document. It is a revelatory document. That means that you have the authority. Now remember, the Ancients of Days authorized Gabriel, sponsored Michael of Nebadon, who Gabriel works for, approved of this plan. And I only say this because it's important. I'm not saying you need to go out and start proselytizing the Urantia book. What I'm saying is figure out a way to introduce people, let them know they need to. I believe that people need to know. They want to know. And that's going to bring up our next subject, which we're going to talk about, which has to do with what's happening in our society, and an article and that references the Gallup poll. And we're going to talk about that in just a second. Okay, we're back, and we want to conclude with another great, I think, topic about an article that I read about the issue of religion in America or in Western culture declining. And it's important because, you know, we're in the thick of this in the fact that we have been introduced to a revelation. And we can see the signs that in some ways society is deteriorating in terms of, well, let me just read to you, because this article sort of accentuates that point, that we are having some issues in America. And how much of that has to do with the decline of religion? And that's what this author is saying, is that if religion declines in America, does that mean that things are going to get worse? He writes, so the next question, why are millennials losing faith faster than all other generations? Now, the Gallup poll says that 47% of those polled no longer belong to or associate with a church, mosque, or synagogue. He says, maybe the American dream of getting married, buying a home with a white picket fence, having kids, attending church or temple, and having a stable career is unattainable for the younger generation, as they are bound by ball and chain to insurmountable student loans, credit card debts, auto loans, and crappy jobs. So the author is saying that, you know, it's not working out for the young people today. They're growing up, and the reason they don't have religion is because life is just difficult. They don't have enough money. They're in debt. So the author wrongly suggests that the American dream somehow was the inventor of the idea of family. The reason that family is declining is because people like freedom. And the media, society, culture seems to frown upon younger people getting married, getting hitched, and having kids. It's almost as if those things get in the way of having a good time. I think that's a big part of it. There's not as much emphasis on the family in American culture as there used to be. There's too many distractions. Urantia book points out that family is the center of society, and we've talked about this in previous podcasts. We've dedicated at least two in recent memory to the importance of family in society. When the family starts to break down, society starts to break down as well. All of our religious ideas, at least the proper ones, come from family. Learning loyalty, faith, trust, hard work, selflessness, altruism, service, discipline, morality, because you learn in your relationships with your father and your mother and your brother and your sister how important it is. Those are the beginnings from a one-year-old to a 10 or 12-year-old, 14-year-old, really. So yeah, the country is dying because of the fact that people are moving away from religious thought, ethical contemplating, Greek philosophy, the fine arts, literature, discussion of modern philosophy. Even science these days is dedicated to activism. What's going on in the outside world? Climate change, genetic manipulation, choosing one's identity based on the agenda they want to be. They're adopting low and debased cultural norms, accepting them almost as virtuous. Even the family unit is under assault. They're wanting to change names in England now. They don't want young children to refer to their ma and pa in using gender. I mean, it's just, you know, there are certain segments of society that want to take 100,000 years and just throw it out the window because they think that maybe they're unique in their approach. So, yeah, you look around. I mean, look at the fact that the number of abortions, and I'm not pro or anti because it's none of my business what anybody does, but it's a reflection of our priorities because every one of those abortions is the result of two people having sexual relations, right? So if the sex was really what mattered and the repercussions of that act didn't, that reflects the moral nature where our priorities are. But by the way, this isn't the first time that this has happened. It's interesting because I started to go back. I was watching the Prince Philip funeral yesterday. It was beautiful. It was so nice. Just, it was interesting from a sociological point of view because of all of that history that went into that ceremony. I truly enjoyed the fact that the world was witnessing and hearing and seeing the results of the better sides of Christianity, the beauty of it, just the angelic beauty of it. And so that was nice to see. But when I looked into the whales and Norway, and I looked at the genealogy of how the British ended up being who they were, I started to stumble on some of the Urantia stuff, and I found some interesting stuff. And it talks about in the history of the races. This is from paper 80, the Cro-Magnoid Blue Man. You want to know where white people came from? A lot of people are having discussions about where did the white race come from? Well, the Urantia book explains how the white folk got here. A lot of it or some of it has to do, our ancestors from the Sangic side are the Blue Man. And I'm talking if you're Anglo-Saxon or Caucasian. Okay. The Blue Man is our Sangic ancestor before Adam and Eve came, according to the Urantia book. So I want to read to you what life was like 35,000 years ago for the Blue Man in Europe. And this is incredibly insightful. And I'm going to let you do most of the extrapolation. I'm just going to read it because it's very interesting. And if you're not familiar with some of the terms, I'll stop and kind of explain them, okay? So from paper 80, talking about, again, this is the origins of the Blue Man, which led to the white races, which led to European dominance, which led to the early pioneers of America and all of that stuff, okay? So we're just talking about history. The origins of things as the Urantia book explains them. The ancient centers of the culture of the Blue Man were located along the rivers of Europe, but only the Somme now flows in the same channel which it followed during these pre-glacial times. While we speak of the Blue Man as pervading the European continent, there were really scores of racial types. Even 35,000 years ago, the European Blue races were already a highly blended people carrying strains of both red and yellow. While on the Atlantic coastlands and in the regions of present-day Russia, they had absorbed a considerable amount of Andonite blood. And now Andonites are the ancestors of the Eskimo or the Inuit, the indigenous northern tribes that we still find today. So the Andonites are the pre-Sangic race. They were the first modern humans, what we call the... what's that group? The Denisovans. And then they write in here back to the story, but it would be fruitless to attempt to enumerate the different many racial groups in existence 35,000 years ago. Needless to say, they're saying that the blue man dominated Europe. The European civilization of this early post-Adamic period was a unique, now post-Adamic meaning Adam and Eve were here 39,000 years ago. They had progeny. They had Adam and Eve, the garden fell, and then they set up their second garden in Mesopotamia, where modern-day Iraq is. And they began to create this race, this Adamic race of offspring who would go and spread about the world and upgrade humanity, upgrade our thinking, upgrade our spiritual receptivity, upgrade our biological status. Man 2.0, right? So the European civilization of this early post-Adamic period was a unique blend of the vigor and the art of the blue man with the creative imagination of the Adamites. The blue men were a race of great vigor, but they greatly deteriorated the cultural and spiritual status of the Adamites. It was very difficult for the latter to impress their religion upon the Cro-Magnoids because of the tendency of so many to cheat and to debauch the maidens. So here is this tribe of Adamites of a few thousand, and they're coming into Europe. They're traveling from Mesopotamia. Again, this is like 30,000 years ago. And they run into this tribe of blue humans, right? Blue in the sense dark blue skin, not black, not a lighter shade, but a kind of a blue hue. The Cro-Magnoids, all right? So that's who they were, really. Cro-Magnoids were one part of the blue men family, just a higher level of perhaps a tribe. And so Adamites meet them, and they start to mingle, and over time, a couple hundred years, the culture of the Adamites starts to deteriorate by these indigenous members. For 10,000 years, religion in Europe was at a low ebb as compared with developments in India and Egypt. Now, think about this for a moment, because the blue man was in Europe, and you had Egypt was already immersed in the Tutankhamun period, building pyramids, and India, and they were developing these intricate religions and these belief systems, right? This was long before written history. We're talking, you know, between 15 and 5,000 years ago, maybe even farther back. And you've got this small tribe of blue in Europe. Here come the Adamites to upgrade them. And they like the blue man. And it reads, paper 80, the blue men were perfectly honest in all their dealings and were wholly free from the sexual vices of the mixed Adamites. So the Adamites brought a greater awareness of sexuality, if you believe it or not. It enhanced the orgasm. The Adamites were the ones that brought play and love and all of these higher emotions to the game of sex, because up to that point, it was purely a biological function among most of the indigenous. The blue man respected maidenhood, only practicing polygamy when war produced a shortage of males. Paper 83, these Cro-Magnons peoples were brave and a far-seeing race. They maintained an efficient system of child culture. Both parents participated in these labors, and the services of the older children were fully utilized. Each child was carefully trained in the care in the caves, in art, and in flint making. Now you're getting a glimpse of early man, 25,000, 30,000 years ago in Europe. At an early age, the women were well-versed in the domestic arts and in crude agriculture, while the men were skilled hunters and courageous warriors. The blue men were hunters, fishers, and food gatherers. They were expert boat builders. They made stone axes, cut down trees, erected log huts, partly below ground, and roofed with hides. And there are people who still build similar huts in Siberia. The southern Cro-Magnoids generally lived in caves and grottos. So then it says about 15,000 years ago, the alpine forests were spreading extensively. What had happened was that there had been a geological change where the winds, what we now call the Pineapple Express, used to go west to east. And that's what made all that land in Africa, northern Africa, just wonderful for agriculture. But it all went away about 15,000 years ago when the rains shifted to the north. And the grazing lands also were affected, and they became covered by forests. These great and relatively sudden climatic modifications drove the races of Europe to change from open space hunters to herders, and in some measure to fishers and tillers of the soil. These changes, while resulting in cultural advances, produced certain biologic retrogressions. During the previous hunting era, the superior tribes had intermarried with the higher types of war captives and had unvaryingly destroyed those who they deemed inferior. But as they commenced to establish settlements and engage in agriculture and commerce, they began to save many of the mediocre captives as slaves. And it was the progeny of these slaves that subsequently so deteriorated the whole Cro-Magnon type. This retrogression of culture continued until it received a fresh impetus from the east when the final and en masse invasion of the Mesopotamians, which is the Adamic and Andite peoples, swept over Europe, quickly absorbing the Cro-Magnon type and culture and initiating the civilization of the white races. So the blue man was absorbed by the Andites, and the Andites are an amalgamation of the Nodites, east to the land of Nod. Remember, the Nodites, part of that 100 group that came a half a million years ago to help civilize humanity in its earlier, almost infant stage. And they became the dominant tribe of Asia, Persia. And when they mated, when Adam's progeny had mated with these Nodites, which we explain. And if you go back to the podcast about Rata, listen to that podcast, because she was really the mother of both the Nodites as well as the Adamites. She was truly a remarkable, sounds like she was a pretty remarkable woman. But there is the story, the white races. Where did they come from? They started out in the original form as the Sangik, or the blue man. And the Urantia book tells us that there were five original races, the yellow, red, blue, green, orange, and indigo. And today, in the brown races, we see an amalgamation of the red and yellow and some indigo. And in the red man, who escaped Asia somewhere about 100,000 years ago and settled in North America, ended up founding what ended up becoming not only the North American red man, but the Central American. And they, of course, when the Europeans came in the 14th, 15th century, amalgamated with them. And so the white races are really an amalgamation of the blue man with a hint of yellow, Asian, and a hint of the red man from 100,000 years ago, and then mixing with the Adamites. And the Adamites basically wiped out the Cro-Magnon, the higher tribe of the blue man, who had dominated most of Europe at that point. And then the Latin inheritance would reappear when the white races would progress civilization for how many years. But they still were lagging behind spiritually. The white races are not a very spiritual group. That's an interesting statement. And I may have to leave it at there. So it doesn't surprise me that in the West we gave up, or were giving up on religion. And partly that has to do with because of the form in which religion takes. We learn in paper 195 that man is naturally suspicious of religion because of the power of the church and because of the abuse of religion. But what isn't lost are the teachings. And we understand that a religion, at least the true religion that the Urantia book talks about, is the religion of personal experience, of searching and then finding your spiritual creator. And that if we each individually are on that journey, then collectively as a society, we are better because we're applying the golden rule. We're serving each other as we would have ourselves be served. See? So religion's contribution to an advancement of society is intellectual as well as spiritual. And while the Blue Man made great intellectual gains during the early years, they never really formed a religion. Whereas in India, they were forming religions left and right. And certainly in Asia, they still had the remnants of the earlier teachings of the garden. They still had the remnants of the earlier teachings going back to the Kaligastia princes back 500,000 years ago. The Bible really has fragments of those early moments in human development. So say the revelators of the Urantia book, that they just stitch it all together for us. And so we've taken a lot of excursions in this episode, and I hope you've enjoyed them. I'm sort of making up for the fact that we've been a little tardy in keeping these podcasts going, and certainly just because of the amount of stuff going on in my life. But I do want to thank each and every one of you listening to these podcasts. I hope you've enjoyed them. We're just trying to share the truth, the revelation. And this world, where we're headed next, depends on a lot of what we do here today, which has always been the case. It's always been the case. So until next time, don't forget, follow us online, urantiaradio.net, and continue to download and share these podcasts. And we'll see you next time right here on the Urantia Radio Podcast. I'm Jim Watkins. God bless.